Our scripture readings for this morning come from the books of Proverbs, Obadiah, and 1 Corinthians. Hear now the word of the Lord. Proverbs 24, verse 17. Do not gloat when your enemy fails. When they stumble, do not let your heart rejoice. Obadiah 1, verses 11 through 14. On that day you stood there and didn't do anything. Strangers took your brother's army into exile. Godless foreigners invaded and pillaged Jerusalem. You stood there and watched. You were as bad as they were. You shouldn't have gloated over your brother when he was down and out. You shouldn't have laughed and joked at Judah's sons when they were face down in the mud. You shouldn't have talked so big when everything was so bad. You shouldn't have taken advantage of my people when their lives had fallen apart. You of all people should not have been amused by their troubles, their wrecked nation. You shouldn't have taken the shirt off their back when they were knocked flat, defenseless. And you shouldn't have stood waiting at the outskirts and cut off refugees and traitorously turned in helpless survivors who had lost everything. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Good morning, church family. I have a really fun pandemic worship story to share with you all. As most of you surely know, the majority of our worship services over the past year have been only virtual. Of course, now with this beautiful late spring weather, we are offering both virtual online services and live services over at Raleigh Little Theater. But throughout the fall, the winter, and early spring, corporate worship for us took place solely online, on Facebook and YouTube, in an attempt to continue giving us all a way to worship together while being separated by distance. Well, back in December and January, I started to notice a name that I didn't recognize showing up every week to our Sunday morning Facebook watch party. Unlike YouTube, on our Facebook watch parties, you can actually see who's there and you can interact through a chat window during the worship service, which has been kind of fun. Curiosity got the better of me, so I did what any good pastor would do and Facebook stalked her. And I found out that she and her husband were from somewhere up in Pennsylvania. And my first thought was, I bet they are friends with Dan and Logan Flecker, or possibly Lacey Fraunfelter and Aaron Tipping, who are all transplants from Pennsylvania. And that's how they must have heard about the church. I reached out to her and eventually connected through Facebook Messenger. And at her request, we set up a phone call because she wanted to learn more about the church. And this is where the story actually becomes even more fun. It turns out it wasn't through Dan or Logan or Lacey or Aaron where she heard about the church. It was through someone else in Raleigh who had never attended a live service, but who had started watching our services on YouTube. Well, I finally met this Raleigh-based friend a couple of Sundays ago at one of our live services at Raleigh Little Theater, and I learned that she has been quite the faithful ambassador for our church, telling a lot of her friends and family about us. She even brought a friend with her on her first Sunday with us. And her mom is a regular attender on YouTube. Hi, Mom. Our conversation when we met was brief, but it was so fun to finally put the puzzle pieces together of this mysterious Pennsylvania connection. I hope I'm not overstating or overrepresenting her enthusiasm about our church, but her comments reminded me very much of the beautiful words that Holly Mills Reston shared last August at our live outdoor 10th anniversary worship service. She talked about some previous church experiences and how she watched loved ones and friends leave the church, not because they wanted to, but because there wasn't space for them there. There wasn't space for questions or mystery. As Holly tells it, after listening to 2 months of our sermon podcasts in the span of 1 week, and then finally attending a live worship service with us, she went home and told her family, "I don't understand why there's not 5,000 people at this church. There needs to be." I love that there is a spaciousness and a big welcome in how we do church. And I love that even people who've never attended a live service with us are finding this to be true online. To use a word from a sermon a couple of weeks ago, we are a faith community that is comfortable with theologalmena, theological reflections and ideas, but held with charity and grace and openness. We are comfortable with uncertainty and with not having everything figured out or nailed down. I think one of the reasons we have become who we are is because we are not content with an oversimplified faith. The faith that so many of us inherited, with all of these clearly delineated black and white lines and tidy, labeled, well-ordered boxes, that faith stopped working some time ago. Over the past 10 and a half years of Ecclesia's life, we have used different language and terms and words to describe the normal, natural, growing pains and phases of a maturing faith. We've used terms like construction, deconstruction, and reconstruction, and orientation, disorientation, and reorientation. But I prefer and really love the language of law, prophet, and wisdom, which is how the Hebrew Scriptures are divided up. Theologian Walter Brueggemann thinks that this division of the Hebrew Scriptures is pure genius because it beautifully represents the ordinary, healthy development of faith in a sequential way: law, prophet, wisdom. In early stage faith, or law faith, we learn the rules, and we learn about our chosenness. We learn about God's great love for us. But faith that stops here tends to turn that chosenness into arrogance, resulting in an us versus them worldview, creating outsiders of anyone who falls beyond the scope of this early understanding of the rules and of God's love. Sometimes this early stage faith can even act violently in defense of its chosenness, unwilling to consider that our thoughts on God might be too small. Eventually, this early stage faith is meant to transition into prophetic faith or critical thinking faith. In simple terms, this is when the boundaries of our early faith get stretched and we begin to see that God's love might be much bigger than we thought. And this is the exact sequence of what happened with the ancient Jewish people. A great example is the prophet Jonah. Jonah desperately wanted God's love to extend only to Israel, but he learned the hard way that God had intended all along to love all people, even their enemies, even the hated Assyrians of Nineveh. And this is prophetic faith. It critiques our earlier understanding and thoughts on God and leads to something bigger and more gracious. For most of America's 200-year evangelical history, prophetic or critical thinking faith has been resisted. The longevity of slavery and segregation are the most obvious illustrations of this resistance. But when the floodgates opened in the 1960s, there was no stopping critical thinking. And now many people of all religious and denominational stripes have moved out of early stage law faith into prophetic or critical thinking or deconstruction faith. Eventually, this is meant to lead to wisdom faith, which is marked by, as Richard Rohr describes it, the beauty and freedom to be patient with mystery and contradictions and with the soul itself. But there is a terrible, awful, sickly, cancerous, but wickedly satisfying habit that often forms in that middle phase, in the prophetic, critical thinking, deconstruction phase. And I see this same terrible habit at play in our political lives, which is something we'll talk a little bit more about later. But it leads me to believe that maybe there is a similar sequential pattern to how we are to mature in politics. Law, prophet, wisdom. Based on the prevalence of this ugly habit, perhaps politically our nation is stuck in this prophetic, critical thinking, deconstruction phase. And so what is this terrible, awful, sickly, cancerous, but wickedly satisfying habit? I'm so glad that you asked. Our texts from Proverbs and Obadiah and 1 Corinthians speak to it. Allow me to describe it to you by way of a confession. A couple of weeks ago, I quoted from the son of a very well-known evangelical pastor who has recently taken to social media to explain his departure from his father's faith. Back on March 3rd, he said this: "Is one of my themes attacking Christianity? No, I don't attack Christianity. I berate evangelicalism, fundamentalism. It's a destructive, narrow-minded worldview, and one of the most destructive, narrow-minded aspects of it is that its adherents feel as if they are the entirety of Christianity rather than the tiny sliver of it that they actually are. Evangelicalism is a toddler tradition that's cousins with Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, and it's the snot-nosed little sibling of mainline Protestant denominations. So, yes, I'm out here saying that fundamentalism is bizarre and anti-intellectual, but that's not me attacking Christianity. Christianity is a big family. I'm just saying that one of the kids is being kind of a brat, and most of the rest of the family agrees." I followed up this quote by saying how much I resonated with what he was saying. In many ways, of all of the children within the big family of Christianity, evangelicalism, and in particular fundamentalism, has been the most resistant to the sequential pattern of growth revealed by the Hebrew Scriptures. They've been the most entrenched in the law phase, the early phase of faith, refusing to move on into the prophetic or the critical thinking phase, which of course means they hardly ever reach the wisdom phase. As such, I frequently distance myself from much of that branch of evangelicalism. And that isn't the sin that I'm confessing. Here's the sin. And saying it out loud makes me all the more ashamed of it. Every time I read a headline or hear a news story about a person in leadership falling from grace from within that particular branch of the big Christian family, it feels good to me. Their scandal feels affirming to my camp. I do not practice Proverbs 24:17. Do not gloat when your enemy falls. When they stumble, do not let your heart rejoice. I don't like this verse. It is one of my least favorites, because there is a twisted, delightful affirmation that accompanies my darkness. The truth is, there is pleasure in gloating. There is pleasure in dark rejoicing, pleasure that is not easy to give up. So while I do not like this verse, I surely do need it. Apparently, this dark delight of mine is not without biblical precedent. In our reading from Obadiah, the same pattern plays out. Within the larger Jewish family of faith, There was the kingdom of Israel to the north with Samaria as her capital, and the kingdom of Judah to the south with Jerusalem as her capital. At one time in history, these two kingdoms were united, and this united kingdom of Israel flourished under the reigns of King Saul and King David and King Solomon. But Solomon's successor, King Rehoboam, he preferred the southern tribes, and he ignored the economic hardships and the complaints of the 10 northern tribes, which resulted in this divided kingdom. And the 10 northern tribes became Israel, and the two southern tribes became Judah. And when the southern kingdom of Judah was conquered by Babylon in the year 586, the people of Israel to the north, they danced and gloated and rejoiced. But more than laughter and ridicule, they even stormed Judah's city gates to steal and pillage and plunder and cast lots for the spoils of Jerusalem. And worse yet, they traitorously turned in survivors who had lost everything and gave them back to Babylon. But back to my confession. My sin gets darker still. It was early last November when I heard the news that a pastor of a big megachurch in New York City, a pastor with a substantial measure of mainstream fame and a lot of A-list celebrities in his congregation, he had a moral failure. When I read the news piece that came out covering the story, I didn't feel bad at all. With each revelation of the story, more damning details were exposed, the scope of which moved beyond sexual indiscretion into all manner of leadership issues and breaches of trust. The article then moved beyond the leader himself and started to critique and tear into the culture that is so often prevalent in megachurch contexts, which it directly faulted as being at least somewhat responsible for creating such a leader in the first place. The dark affirmation found in their scandal is like emotional heroin. It is unbelievably addictive. Candidly, I knew that I was sinning, but this has always felt like a permissible, even justifiable sin, because they are bad, right? It felt like a small indiscretion, and I've been doing this for years. This headline of the New York pastor is only a recent example, and not even the most recent. I've been following a Twitter account for 5+ years that is pretty much dedicated to feasting on these types of stories. Stories of failed religious and political leaders. In more sober moments, I recognize that the only reason Twitter accounts like this exist is because there are thousands of us who love to feast on these types of stories. It's only been recently that I've come to see how this long-standing favorite sin of mine is creating rot and decay in my soul. And what helped me see the rot and decay was a realization that not only was it mesmerizing to fixate on the darkness, but as I was reading these stories, I wanted the darkness to be darker still. I don't want to make any assumptions about your own journey from law faith into prophetic faith, but most people I know who enter into prophetic critical thinking faith, they are drawn to this sin like a thirsty man to water. And sadly, we all fail to realize that it isn't water. It's a mirage. It's just sand in the desert. C.S. Lewis knew about this temptation as well, and he wrote about it brilliantly in his book, Mere Christianity, which I read for the very first time only recently. And he says this: suppose one reads a story of filthy atrocities in the paper, then suppose that something turns up suggesting that the story might not be quite true, or not quite so bad as it was made out. Is one's first feeling, oh, thank God, even they aren't quite so bad as that? Or is it a feeling of disappointment and even a determination to cling to the first story for the sheer pleasure of thinking your enemies are as bad as possible? If it is the second, then it is, I am afraid, the first step in a process which, if followed to the end, will make us into devils. You see, one is beginning to wish that black was a little blacker. And if we give that wish its head, later on we shall wish to see gray as black, and then to see white itself as black. Finally, we shall insist on seeing everything, God and our friends and ourselves included, as bad, and not be able to stop doing it. We shall be fixed forever in a universe of pure hatred. As mentioned earlier, this dark pleasure is also rampant in our political lives. In fact, it is hard to imagine modern politics without it, without feasting upon their scandal, the other's scandal, whichever side you happen to be on. Our culture of a 24-hour news cycle of partisan politics feasts on headlines of humiliating stories of political rivals. And that culture exists because of our insatiable appetite to feast upon these stories, making them millions of dollars of profit in the process. We are money in the bank when it comes to this. And the networks know it. We love the dark stories of the other side. And as C.S. Lewis so accurately describes, if we catch wind of something suggesting the story might not be quite so bad as originally thought, we feel the disappointment, and we willingly contort ourselves into whatever mental gymnastics are required in order to cling to that original story for the sheer pleasure that comes with thinking the enemy is as bad as possible. And of course, this happens in far more places than just religion and politics. It happens in workplaces. It happens in broken friendships and relationships. It's the assumed posture of most anyone who has gone through a divorce. It even happens with complete strangers, when somehow, when we look at them, we feel less than, and so we slip into a darkened imagination to take them down a notch or two. Because the dark comfort we find there is better than feeling less than. But love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. And if love does not delight in evil, that must mean it does not rejoice in unrighteousness, in the sins, the brokenness, and the mistakes of others. Love doesn't do that. Love doesn't hope the darkness to be darker still. Love always protects. Love always trusts. Love always hopes and perseveres. On Thursday, while writing this sermon at Common Grounds in Apex, seated at one of the long community tables, just after 12 noon, I officially stopped following the Twitter account that I've been following for 5+ years. And if I'm being completely honest, I already miss it. But if Proverbs 24:17 is ever going to become a reality in my life, this is an absolutely necessary first step. So how can we battle this terrible, awful, sickly, cancerous, but wickedly satisfying habit? Here are just 3 quick thoughts I want to offer in closing. First, pray. Resist the temptation to talk about them, and instead pray for them. Remember, in addition to your words in prayer potentially impacting the one you are praying for, one of the greatest powers of prayer is that it changes us. And praying for someone whose failure we've been taking delight in, that has the potential of changing and reshaping our hearts. Rather than hoping the darkness to be darker still, we might begin to hope for the opposite. It seems that G.K. Chesterton had landed here, always hoping the darkness might be lighter than previously supposed. In the London Daily News in 1901, he wrote this: "There is nothing so satisfying as finding that some man is better than we thought. There is no sensation so pleasant to a generous spirit as being convicted of underestimating another's character." Oh, how I would love to arrive at G.K. Chesterton's heart disposition on this. Second, you are not immune from failure and missteps. And so here's some advice. Sow grace to reap grace, because one day you will be the one needing it. Third, trust God. The court of public opinion and the internal judicial system that we all carry within us will attempt to be the judge and jury, but our judgments will always fall short. The great news for all of us is that the one who judges us most finally will be the one who loves us most fully. What great news that is for us all. Typically, we end our messages with everyone closing their eyes and offering a prayer. But I want to do something slightly different today. I want to use a liturgy I wrote. The title is a bit cumbersome, I admit, but I don't really care. I've titled it "A Liturgy for Resisting the Dark Pleasures of Another's Fall." And maybe you are a modern-day G.K. Chesterton, and what I've spoken about this morning is completely foreign to you and is something you have never wrestled with. I hope that is the case for some of you. But for the rest of us, I hope that this liturgy will help. So please read it with me. Jesus, here I am again, reveling in the misdeeds and missteps and misfortunes of another, darkly feasting on the humiliation of someone I've pitted myself against. But you, O Christ, are not pitted against them. You are as for them as you are for me. You desire their restoration as deeply as you desire my own. Given the choice between grace or gloating, for too long I've chosen the foul pleasure of gloating. It has become like a dark honey that I can no longer resist, but it is slowly bringing rot and decay to my soul. To know the one who judges us most finally will be the one who loves us most fully, this is little comfort to me, for there are those I do not wish to be judged in love. But how can this be? How did I arrive here? Change me, for this is not who I want to be. Change me, for this does not make me a credit to the message of Christ. Be my strength. I am shadowed. Be my light. I am selfish. Unmake me now and refashion my desires according to the better designs of your love. Amen.